It can be tough proving a negative, the absence of something in this economy, but we are gonna do it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Thursday, I believe the 22nd of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to start today with a story about something in this economy that is not there, that isn't happening, and what that means. We're going to set it up by noting that 787,000 people lost their jobs last week and made first-time claims for unemployment benefits, less than the week prior, it should be said, and also that the Labor Department adjusted downward its numbers for the previous couple of weeks. And that's good. It really is. But the number of people on government assistance because they have lost their jobs is still stratospherically high. Millions of them are running out of benefits, and as you know, those extra $600 a week went away in August. And that, to get back to the thing that's missing, is sucking billions of dollars out of this economy compared to earlier in the pandemic. How many billions? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman gets the lead story today.
The answer is $20 billion a week. That's how much is not getting into out-of-work Americans' pockets since a bunch of federal assistance programs for the unemployed started running out in mid-summer. Andrew Stettner at the Century Foundation says based on Treasury data, they were getting $26 billion a week.
That has come crashing down to just $6 billion. It's much less support to families and to the economy than we had.
$600 a week in federal pandemic payments expired at the end of July. The president's partial replacement program ran out of money last month. Also, folks laid off back in March and April are now running out of their 26 weeks of state jobless benefits. Some, but not all, are getting a 13-week federal extension. Unemployment benefits now average $320 a week across the country. It's even less for gig workers on pandemic unemployment assistance. And that has made a huge dent in the purchasing power of households suffering unemployment, says Mark Hamrick at Bankrate.com.
They are really having to scrape to get by these days just for basic needs, such as to pay for shelter, pay the bills, to put food on the table, and forget about luxuries.
That's exactly what Brooke Wetzel has seen play out in her florist business in L.A. When the economy started to open up in late spring, sales picked up. But since August,
things have gotten pretty slow. People not having that, you know, extra $50 to $75 for a flower arrangement.
So Wetzel's working part-time now, spending the rest with her homeschooling kids. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We learned in our Marketplace Edison Research poll that came out last week that 47% of Americans would have at least some trouble handling an unexpected expense of $250. They just don't have the income or the savings. Companies are starting to realize that, and that helping employees save might be a competitive advantage right now. UPS, for instance, is going to start offering some of its workers a short-term savings account inside their 401ks. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has that one.
Zach Champa, a financial planner at John Hancock, says making the decision to save money is like starting a diet. Not very fun, easy to mess up, and pretty intimidating.
And I think at that point, people just fizzle out and say, you know, I don't feel like taking too much of my time, effort, and energy to figure this out.
He says a push from an employer that makes savings easy and automatic could go a long way to help people commit to a savings account. Dean Carlin is an economist at Northwestern University. He says there are good reasons to have a savings pot that's not linked to your bank accounts.
If it's a bit more out of sight, because it's not the place you go to on a daily basis, maybe it requires a little bit more work to withdraw, you're more likely to leave it in there. And that is a nice behavioral trick to try to help people accumulate savings.
Some company-sponsored savings programs come with a bonus for opening an account. The UPS program is tied to employees' 401ks. Unlike regular 401ks, the emergency savings contributions are not pre-tax, though there are no fees for pulling invested money out. Employees do have to keep tabs on how their investments are doing versus a bank savings account that builds tiny bits of interest.
There has been a small trickle of companies that have been trying this out, but this is still pretty experimental.
James Choi, who teaches finance at Yale, says there's little data on whether these accounts help build up significant savings. But he says employers are willing to offer them if there's a chance they'll reduce employees' financial stress.
That's going to affect their productivity at the workplace. And so there's a hope that this sort of program might even pay for itself.
Of course, that only works if employees have extra money to squirrel away. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this Thursday, up just a bit, waiting, I suppose, for relief package news. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I mentioned briefly last week on the program an item from Fitch, the ratings people, that this country's credit rating could suffer, making borrowing more expensive, of which we are doing a lot, by the way, borrowing. Anyway, it would suffer if there's not a peaceful transfer of power after the election. And that prompted this, a conversation about all the other ways this election might make mischief with this economy if it's not normal. Wendy Edelberg is the director of the Hamilton Project. She's also a senior fellow at Brookings. Wendy, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much for having me.
So broad brush, lay it out for me. We have been told that we're probably not going to know who won the election on election night. What do you think that means writ large for the American economy in the next 2 months?
I suspect it means that it will take too long to get the kind of fiscal support that we need to support this really fragile recovery. And that frustrates me because doing it now is too late. Doing it a month from now is much too late.
What happens? So I will stipulate that is a thing that could or will happen on election night or afterward. What happens if it becomes contested and challenged and acrimonious?
So right now, measures that tell us how uncertain things are for businesses, for investors, for households, those measures are through the roof, and uncertainty is generally really bad for economic activity. It prevents firms from putting investments in place and expanding and putting in hiring decisions, and it prevents households from making decisions about the future. And we're just going to create one more really significant headwind if November and December, for that matter, is that much more an environment of uncertainty layered on top of the immense uncertainty we have because of the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. I say on this program all the time, and regular listeners know this, the stock market is not the economy. I do wonder, though, beyond the real economy measures that you have laid out in that answer, what do you imagine stock markets will do? Just because a lot of people look at that as an indicator.
So you're absolutely right. The stock market is not the economy. And the stock market is giving us all sorts of incorrect signals right now. And it wouldn't really surprise me if it continued to give us really incorrect signals. As much as uncertainty and a contested election would be really bad for small businesses, for individual households, it may well be good for some of the large firms that are driving the stock market gains. That's really hard to know. And I'm also guessing that people who hold equities are pretty aware of the issues that you and I just talked about. And so my thought is that that's mostly baked into the stock market. And so those investors are expecting things to be pretty chaotic for a couple of weeks after the election. I would expect things to basically move sideways. I mean, which is to say the flip side, that if we get a clear outcome and uncertainty is largely resolved very quickly, I can imagine that being fabulous for the stock market.
Huh. Let me point out that if he loses, President Trump will still be president for 2.5 months, right? Election day to the 20th of January. Contested election aside, challenged election aside, random tweets aside, he's still the president with full executive authority to influence this economy.
So maybe this means that with all of these issues leading up to the election off the table, because that uncertainty is resolved, mm-hmm. I don't know, maybe we can hope. Maybe policymakers will then come together and do the right thing. I've been asked before, what will you tell policymakers on January 20th to do to support our economy? Mm. And the first thing I'll say is get in a time machine and go back 6 months to support the economy then. So I have grave concerns about policymakers waiting until January to pass the kind of fiscal support that the economy needs right now.
Wendy Edelberg. She is the director of the Hamilton Project, also senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Wendy, thanks for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
The longer this pandemic lasts, the more likely it seems that those of us who can are going to be working from home forever. A new S&P Global survey shows nearly two-thirds of organizations say a significant increase in remote working is going to be permanent. Granted, there are many who love working remotely. No commute, more flexibility, pajamas. But Marketplace's Mariel Segarra heard from a lot of people who have found it real, real challenging.
Richard Fine began our conversation with a warning about the hammering sound I was about to hear. His downstairs neighbor has recently undertaken some construction.
That's just, you know, the joys of working from home.
Fine, who talked to me from the bedroom of his Manhattan apartment because his wife and son were working and learning remotely in the other rooms, is an executive at ZocDoc, the doctor appointment booking site.
We have committed to the full company that we will not mandate people to come back until Labor Day of 2021.
And Fine doesn't love working from home.
No, I think it's a pretty inferior form of work.
Remote working is leaving Niall Akan kind of frayed, too. She's the head of talent at the healthcare company Eden Health and a single mom living in a small apartment in Queens with her six-year-old daughter, who's doing school online.
I feel like I'm a meaner mom to her because my patience is immediately low now compared to before. And my stress is incredibly high. And she claps back pretty hard. She's like, Mommy, you just yelled at me. That was not nice.
She is grateful that she gets to spend more time with her daughter. At the same time, she misses interacting with her colleagues in person. So does Kate Adams in Milton, Massachusetts. She's a marketing executive at a tech company called Drift. She has friends at the office.
You know, Fridays at 4 o'clock, send up the bat signal and we'd go like join each other in the kitchen and grab a glass of wine and hang out and just like decompress. Like I miss that desperately.
Last she heard, the office probably won't reopen until June. So for now, she and her coworker have come up with this game.
We have a contest sometimes when we're on Zooms, like if we can make each other laugh.
They even keep score. It's not the same, but it's the best they've got right now. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
You can hear Mariel on the Marketplace Morning Report every now and then, too, you know. David Brancaccio and the gang on the early shift. Everything you need to know to start your economic day. Check it out. Coming up.
I've spent thousands of dollars on language acquisition, some of which was a complete waste.
Some, but not all, maybe. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials picked up 152 points today, about 0.5%, 28,363. NASDAQ added 21 points, about 0.2%, 11,506. The S&P 500 found 17 points, 0.5%. 34 and 53 there. According to an analysis by the Wall Street Journal, the 20 cities and counties with the biggest police departments paid out more than $2 billion for alleged misconduct and civil rights violations since 2015. The journal found New York City alone paid about half of that. The National Association of Realtors says sales of existing homes rose 9.4% in September, slightly more than expected, but there's only a 2.7-month supply of homes to buy, the lowest since that group began keeping track in 1982. You know what that means, right? Supply, demand. Prices are going up for houses. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. I read an article in the Wall Street Journal a couple of weeks ago that got me thinking about the conversation we have been having in this country about inclusion in the workplace specifically, since that's our thing, and what leadership has to do with that. Wynn Noland is the CEO of an insurance and financial services company in Melville, New York, called Bradley and Parker. She was the subject of that article. Ms. Noland, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kai.
Do me a favor, would you, and tell me about that email you sent to the whole company back in 2017, about 6 months, I guess, after you became the CEO.
So I had decided to transition my gender and took a couple of weeks off to take care of some of the things that were needed to do that. And prior to sending that email, I had let the senior members of our management team know what was going on. But the rest of the team, probably 60 or 70 people, received the news first via that email on that Tuesday morning in May.
So how did it go?
It really went beyond my greatest expectations. You know, as you might imagine, something like this is anxiety producing. Yeah. Many things about our personal lives, we don't necessarily make public at work, nor do I think a lot of it should be. But how one presents themselves gender-wise, there's really no way to hide that. So you need to address it. And my experience has been, even when people have a particular notion or particular viewpoints on things, something like being a transgendered person, it's nothing they've really had experience with. Mm. And when it comes to someone they actually know, I think it forces them to then kind of come to a resolution about this person that they know versus whatever negative things they may have heard in the past.
Which gets us to present day, as it were, right? Because 3 years ago, you tell your colleagues, you tell the board, your customers, your clients, and things are, in my understanding, reasonably okay. And then there's a story in the Journal. There's an interview you do on Fox Business. And for all we know, after this interview, you have gotten some blowback. And I want to talk about how you reacted to that and then why you're being so open about some of these developments in your company as they are affected by your personal life.
Yes, so that's a great point, Kai. We did get a couple of really kind of negative blowbacks, as you mm-hmm. called them, from mm-hmm. that. One was a telephone message that I received on my work line, and another was an email that was sent to our team. Somebody had actually taken the trouble to go onto our website and copy down all of the email addresses that we have listed there so they could send basically what was a hate message out to the entire team. So, you know, you ask how I feel about that. Well, mm-hmm. it really doesn't faze me too much, to be candid, because when we think about the fact that really all we had was a couple of negative blowbacks is really inconsequential.
I imagine, well, I can't even imagine, but one guess is, I suppose, you've got a lot of motivation for doing this. One of them, I would suppose, is leading from the front, leading by example, showing that you can make this transition in a very public way, still be a successful CEO. Your company's doing very well, I understand. So that's part of what's going on here. But I suppose it does have to be pointed out that you're affluent, you're in a position of power at work, and so it's been easier for you than many for whom this transition would have been incredibly difficult.
So that is so, so true. And whenever I talk about this to people in the community, I realize I've had an easier time with my transition because of that privilege you speak of. I like to tell a quick story about how I was changing my driver's license, changing the gender marker mm-hmm. on my driver's license. And here I was, very professionally dressed. I have a fairly powerful presence about me, and mm-hmm. I had to speak to three different people at the Department of Motor Vehicles because they were doubting the validity of one of the letters from my doctors. And I remember I eventually prevailed, but I remembered when I got in my car saying to myself, wow, I wonder if I was a transgendered person of color, say, I don't know, 22 or 23 years old, what that outcome would have been. They probably would have gotten in that car without that license being changed.
Wynn Noland, she is the CEO of Bradley & Parker. Ms. Noland, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me, Kai. You have a wonderful day.
You too. Lockdowns are coming back in one form or another in some parts of the country as the number of virus cases goes up, which means, just like it did in the early days, a lot of people are going to be looking for something to fill the time, work on a project, learn a new skill, maybe a language. That's what those language learning app companies are noticing, more potential users, so developers are trying to find new ways to engage them. Duolingo's bid for more ears? That now tried and true audio formula, a true crime podcast in Spanish. Marketplace's Andy Euler has that one.
The story is about a bank heist in Buenos Aires, Argentina in 2006.
It was the dog days of summer, and most of the city was on vacation. But not Rodolfo Palacios.
Eran mis primeros meses.
We knew that true crime was just such a popular genre.
Michaela Crone is a spokesperson for Duolingo who worked on the podcast.
We were trying to think through, like, how do we adapt this unique format that we've created for language learning and add in this true crime element to kind of cross those over?
Clearly, the pandemic presented an opportunity to grow the business. As lockdown orders came into place around the world in March, she says Duolingo saw a 100% increase in new users. Eric Lindhorst has been trying to learn Spanish for about 3 years now.
I've spent thousands of dollars on language acquisition, some of which was a complete waste and some of which was super valuable.
He says he used to use Duolingo quite a bit, but ran out of free content a while ago. The app is free, but you can pay for a subscription to unlock more stuff. He'll probably check out the Duolingo True Crime podcast as long as he doesn't have to pay for it, but says there's so much good free content on the internet already. Sean Lowen teaches language acquisition at Michigan State University. He says language programs tend to overpromise, whether you're paying or not, but the long-form narrative might work.
Any exposure to the target language is good. If you understand the larger sense of things because it's part of it has been told to you in English, and then you hear something in Spanish, you're more likely to understand that because you're able to kind of fill in with some of your other background knowledge.
Especially when it comes to vocabulary and simple phrases. He says straddling the line of entertainment and education is something these apps do well. But whether you'll be ready for that trip to Barcelona in 2022 is another question altogether. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, I'm going to give you a couple of seconds to cover the kids' ears if they're nearby, so go do that. Okay, that should do it. I'm sorry, Virginia, but there is no Santa Claus this year. Breaking a tradition that dates back to the 1860s, there is not going to be a Santa Claus at the Macy's flagship store in New York City, or the one in Chicago, or the store in San Francisco. Pandemic, of course. The chain is going to do an online thing. You can tour his virtual workshop and take a selfie with him, I guess. And he'll still be there at the end of the Thanksgiving Day parade. But, you know, bummer. And we are out of here, but not without your Thursday moment of economic context. A quick follow on to where we started, joblessness, Mitchell's story and what that means for the wider economy. As I think we pointed out before, there is an official measure of exactly how many people are getting government unemployment assistance in total. It's called Persons Claiming UI for Unemployment Insurance Benefits in All Programs. So for the week ended October 3rd, 23,150,427 people out of work. Amir Bibawi, Siobhan Brett, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Kat Green, Rick Carr, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.